Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where today we're asking, how do you adapt a novel? For film, sure, but also for the theatre and even the little old radio. How do you turn 350 pages of prose into drama? We'll hear from Ben Wheatley, director of the Talk of the Town adaptation of J.G. Ballard's novel High Rise. We'll also hear from David Nichols, author of the international bestseller One Day, who adapted his own book for the cinema. And we'll have words to the wise from my dynamic duo of studio guests, the writer Philip Meeks and the adaptation consultant, no less, Charmaine Lovegrove. That's all to come on today's episode of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Do stay tuned. So today we're discussing how you adapt a novel. Joining me in the studio is Charmaine Lovegrove, co-founder of Dialogue Scouting, page-to-screen consultancy, and the writer Philip Meeks. Welcome to the show, both of you. Thank you very much for coming in on an early Monday morning.
Thanks
to
for
kind of spill
us.
The beans on this fascinating subject. We're going to do this show in a few different parts, and we're going to take this conversation first of all in two halves, focusing on the creative and the business sides of turning a novel into a play, TV series or a film. Throughout the show, we'll be hearing from authors, directors and screenwriters who will talk us through their endeavours to put the written word onto the screen. And to kick the conversation off, we're going to meet the director Ben Wheatley. Wheatley has had the tall task of turning J.G. Ballard 1970s dystopian drama High Rise into a film, which he's done with his screenwriter wife Amy Jump. That film is out now, and here's Wheatley in conversation with the Picture House's Paul Ridd as part of a Q&A as that film premiered last week.
They've been trying to make the film for a long time. I think the film had been optioned in like 76, the book was written in 75. They'd been around for a long time and they'd been trying to get it made, and I had no idea about any of this. So I basically came to it kind of a year or so before production and just was sitting at home and thought, well, you know, I saw it on my shelf and I thought, why hasn't it been made? And it was a particular favourite book of mine when I was a kid. And I'd kind of dipped in and out of Ballard subsequently. But when I went back and reread it, it felt like it was incredibly prescient, and that from what I'd read before, when I read it in the kind of late 80s, early 90s, it was quite close to when it'd been written, and it felt like a kind of, it fitted in with that kind of predictive kind of dystopian fiction. But when I reread it, it felt like it had happened. And I think that was the moment I kind of thought, well, this would be really interesting to kind of make it as a movie. But obviously, just dipping into your own bookshelf and pulling books off the side and hoping to make them is quite random. How it usually works is you do that, and then you get a rights search on it and try and find out if anyone's got it. And usually they have. You know, most novels have been bought up by Hollywood. I mean, they don't just buy books, they buy authors, or they buy whole genres now. You know, and it's just a kind of total clearance of all kind of cultural products. So I didn't hold out much hope, you know, that it was available. But it was, and it was being held by Jeremy Thomas, who produced Crash and Naked Lunch, amongst many, many other movies. And it all moved very quickly from there. You know, within 3 days of kind of re-looking at the book, I was talking to Jeremy, you know, and that was the start of it.
You built all this.
I put all my energies into this tower, but I am the architect of my own accident.
Is that a horse?
Probably.
On the 40th floor.
Her husband appears intent on colonizing the sky.
And who can blame him when you look at what's going on at street level?
How's the high life?
Prone to fits of mania, narcissism, and power failure.
Ooh. In terms of the sort of writing process, obviously, the book being close to your heart, one that was kind of formative, what was the approach there? Obviously, you're collaborative with Amy Jump. Did you sort of go through line by line? Was it quite a sort of torturous process of being as faithful as possible?
Or according to the BBC, I allowed Amy Jump to write the script.
Strange terminology.
Yeah, I think it's because we're married and it's like there's some kind of weird mega sexism going on. Or that they felt that it's a 70s book, that they thought it was appropriate to talk about it in a kind of 70s sexist kind of way, you know. And it's not really how we work, you know. I love the image of like the kind of the director in his smoking jacket stalking about, kind of like ripping pages out of the book going, here you go, this is going to be great, you know. And it's not like that at all, you know. I have no contact with her while she writes, I'm just a massive irritation. And it's dangerous even to ask how it's going, I've found. You just keep your head down and hope that it's going to get finished at some point, which it was really quickly. And then I read it and I thought it was great. But I don't then write her a load of notes and tell her what to do. I would never do that. I'd be too afraid. You know, we've been together since we were like 16. So I kind of, that's our relationship, working relationship has always been like that. You know, my big creative moment on the project was pulling the book off the shelf. But she won't come out and she won't do Q&As and she won't do press or anything. So it always looks like I take all the credit, which I do, obviously, you know, because I'm here. But all the movies we've done together are much more, you can see that they're movies made by a couple. And also that now, increasingly, we're trying to get the crediting right, you know, and so the split credit at the end just now, the directed by and written by credit being on the same card, is a trying to rebalance that kind of idea, you know, break this kind of auteur filmmaking bollocks, which is that the director does everything. A director will take credit for everything, but it doesn't necessarily do everything.
Doing the dirty there on the creative process, and we're talking today on The Culture Show about how you adapt a novel. That was Ben Wheatley, the director of the brand new High Rise, and you can catch the full interview on last week's edition of our cinema show here on Monocle 24. I'm with Philip Meeks, the writer, and also Charmaine Lovegrove, co-founder of Dialogue Scouting. Philip, we'll come to you first, because I want to know about this creative impulse. Ben Wheatley there saying that his great sort of creative impulse in this whole thing of adapting High Rise was simply to pull it off the shelf. This is kind of in my ignorance, this is kind of how I think these things work. For you as an adapter of books and turning them into plays and radio plays as well, tell us about that first instinct that leads you to think that something will be good, not as a book, but coming out of your radio, for example.
Yeah, well, I think what I love about adapting is you're taking something that works as a fantastic piece of art and then starting to turn it into something else which will perhaps work in its own right. I think what I look for, I'm not a big believer in, you know, you get told you've got an authored voice. I'm not a big believer in all of that. It's a bit, it all seems a bit sort of strange to me. But I think you've got to have something that chimes with your imagination. So at the moment I'm developing a radio project, and I found these, I sort of spend hours on Amazon looking and Goodreads looking for obscure books that are out of print that I can buy for £2.81 and sort of frantically read. And I found this series of books by a British author called Harry Keating, and they're the Inspector Gautier books. And I just thought they were phenomenal and a wonderful domestic political books. So then you think, well, where would this work? And you have to always have your awareness of budgets and money. And I just thought this would work brilliantly on radio. You would capture the period. You would capture the nature of the stories, which are not necessarily thrill a minute. And so that's why I took that idea to radio, and that's I'm currently developing them in that context.
So you can imagine straight away, you're not reading it, and you say you trawl the internet looking for books,
yes,
that you could buy. But I mean, are you looking for the synopses of books? Are you looking for the very bare bones of the story?
No,
are you looking
I have
for
to read,
character?
I look for a character and an idea in a synopsis, and then I read the book, and it's just whether or not, as I read it, I can see it, or I can see a version of the story emerging from it. And that's how I have a list of books that I would like to tackle.
Okay.
And I've done a bit of work working with companies, you know, going specifically to find, for example, new routes into crime. And it's just, you know, you sort of develop a bit of a reputation as a writer in certain areas. And that seems to be where I've got a bit of a reputation at the moment. So I like having a bit of a reputation.
A little bit of a reputation. Charmaine, does that sort of chime with you? We should say, actually, that your company works in a very interesting way. Maybe you'd like to set that up for our listeners, because it's maybe as Ben Wheatley said in that clip we heard, you know, people, he just pulled the book off the shelf. Philip sitting next to you, you know, is looking, always looking for stories, but you kind of do it the other way around.
Yeah, so it's a little bit of the two processes between pulling the book off the shelf and also sort of searching. But the point in which I'm coming from is working directly in my company. We're the only company in Europe that just does this, which is to really find what the producers are looking for and to spend time with the producers and work as their kind of external literary development team. So what we do is we go in every week, we speak to the producers, we find out what's on their slate, what they're working on, what they're interested in, what has interested them over the weekend, the Sunday papers, and then we go out to publishers and agents and we read and we just demand to read everything that comes out on our sort of wish list of books that our producers want to make.
Okay, well, that's a really interesting way of doing business, I guess. And you're kind of, it's not the opposite way around to how Ben Wheatley did it in that clip or how Philip's doing it. But I guess you're looking for stories that exist that are out there in the public consciousness, or producers are, and you're looking to back that up to find some literary way that that exists and then sort of back engineer a movie script out of a novel that exists of a news story that's sort of out there in the ether.
Exactly.
That's quite a niche you found for yourself.
It is the niche of the niche. And so I got into this from being a bookseller. And, you know, the best thing about being a bookseller is that anyone comes into your bookshop and they ask you for a book and they say, it's got a red cover and it's set in China. And then they tell you about it and you're like, actually, it's blue and it's a blue cover and it's set in India. And so, you know, that's the kind of quick fire you need to be a bookseller that I felt was not as appreciated as it should be within the publishing industry. So as the demise of bookshops came about, unfortunately, I moved to Berlin, opened a bookshop, started working for UFA, and then it's kind of continued from there. I met my business partner, Toby Coventry, and we basically sidelined this area of understanding exactly what it is that producers want. And what we do is that we bring the books and we bring the stories, and they will sometimes not be published. They will sometimes just be out on submission, but we'll get like the hot buzz of what's coming out between London, New York and LA, and also internationally. We'll know what broadcasters are looking for. You know, it's a very, very fickle thing that changes week to week. So
this is amazing. So you have a weekly consultation with the producers. You have that's kind of amazing. That's very reactive. People, I think, would be surprised to hear that it is that fast paced, and that, you know, somewhat a book that they were considering one week will not be cutting the mustard the week afterwards.
Absolutely. And, you know, there'll be so many different layers to that. And I think that you can say, Philip, that when you're meeting with development producers, that, you know, we were talking earlier and saying that they change their mind. And it depends on what happened at breakfast.
So this, we're talking about the fickle nature of this now then, Philip. Let us into this. What are the first marks you make on a text, I wonder? And do you always have to phone a producer before breakfast so that they don't have an egg that disagrees with them?
Often what's happened is I've been, it's through working with companies and being on their development slate, you know, pitching ideas, it usually emerges from that. So you end up, for example, I took a book to somebody very high up at ITV and they positioned it with a development person at ITV, and that was a couple of years ago. So sometimes the route is through...
It's slightly tortuous.
Yes, well, it is tortuous. Yeah. And I did have an experience recently, which, you know, obviously naming no names, in which it was quite clear that the person who was in charge of the development hadn't read the books. And... and didn't read any of my treatments. And I think there are two big myths. You get off on the wrong foot if you believe either of these things, that the worst books make the best screenplay. That is just a fable. And throw the book away. You know, do your own thing. Yeah. That is a myth as well. You have to retain the spirit of the book, otherwise you might as well just create an original idea. You have to honour the people who are watching the product because they love the book.
One of the big things that I'm working with constantly and talking to publishers about is that when a book does really well in the publishing sphere, then every single publisher wants to get a "this is like this book."
Yes.
Whereas in film and television, it's the exact opposite. So we've already had Downton Abbey, so we're not looking for anything that is of that period with those kinds of characters, because we've already been in that world for numerous series and it's been really successful, and nobody wants to try and top that. They want to try, you know, producers want to come up with something really original. So that's where it's really interesting, is that you're really trying to look for what's next. And that's where there is this sort of tension between publishing and film and television, because there doesn't seem to be this understanding of how the two industries work.
It's a fascinating difference. Maybe we'll come on to that. We're going to have another clip now from David Nichols, storied, celebrated novelist and adapter as well. Philip and Charmaine, hold your horses. We're going to come back. But first, we're going to hear from the writer, David Nichols. He's responsible for the 2009 bestseller One Day, which he then rewrote for the silver screen in 2011. More recently, he also adapted Thomas Hardy's Far From the Madding Crowd, which hit cinemas last year, starring Kerry Mulligan. He tells Monocle's Megan Billings about his approach to this classic novel and the difference between adapting your own work and someone else's.
Perhaps you'd care to lend a hand.
You don't think I would?
No, you wouldn't.
Well, I've loved Hardy since I was a teenager. Hardy and Dickens, you know, they were the first kind of proper classics that I read and loved, and I found them very moving and very exciting and beautifully written. And some years later, I was asked to adapt Tess of the D'Urbervilles as a four-parter for the BBC, and I loved doing that. And soon after, the offer came to do Far From the Madding Crowd, and I hesitated slightly because I don't want to just do 19th century novels, and it's a novel that's been adapted before, and it's a novel that's very hard to adapt. So I was a little hesitant, but I eventually took it on, and that was about 5 years ago, and here we are.
I actually wanted to bring that up. So this isn't the first time that you've done this, and I think the most obvious thing is that when you're adapting a book that is a classic, it's quite long and you have to shorten it, so you have to leave things out. So how do you approach that?
Well, the novel is very episodic. I mean, Hardy writes in sort of set pieces. That's not to say it doesn't have a plot, but he's not afraid to stop and go off on a tangent and maybe explore the life of, say, the workers on the farm or explore the backstory of the characters. And that stuff is the first stuff to go. The ending of the novel is wonderful, but it's very melodramatic. It's kind of crazy. There's a whole sequence where Troy comes back in disguise and Bathsheba sees him perform in a circus and doesn't know it's him, and he sees it in the audience, and it's sort of crazy, but a very hard thing to do in the more realistic medium of films. So we pulled back on some of the melodrama. We wanted it to be a kind of close-up movie, I suppose. We wanted to focus in on the five main characters and have a series of very dramatic, almost two-hander scenes between them. So that was the area we focused in on.
From now on, you have a mistress, not a master. I don't yet know my talents in farming, but I shall do my best. Don't suppose because I'm a woman I don't know the difference between bad goings on and good. I shall be up before you are awake. I shall be afield before you are up. It is my intention to astonish you all. Back to work, please.
I like the idea very much that you are an author as well as a screenwriter, and that you actually wrote One Day and then adapted it to the screen. So you've been through this with your own work, and I wonder if that makes you different than maybe another screenwriter who's adapting a book.
Adapting your own work is a unique experience and uniquely frustrating, because you've lived with this thing for 3 years and you've played it in your head and you know everything about it. You know what the characters look like and what they're wearing and what music's playing in the background. You're basically doing everything in the form of a novel. And then when you become the screenwriter, you have to hand over that responsibility to a whole load of other people. And that's great, because often, you know, they surprise you and they envision it in an entirely different way. But also really frustrating, because your power is suddenly, you know, horribly diminished. You know, with a novel, it's just me. There's no one else. I mean, I have a very good editor, but the text is basically all mine. And with a movie, it's you're part of a team of 100, and you have to be prepared to abdicate some responsibility. Adapting someone else's work, I suppose I think of myself more as an editor. I suppose there's a kind of technical quality to the work, because a lot of it is about distilling and reducing. A lot of it is about how you get the character's internal life, their emotions, their thoughts and emotions onto the screen. Because a novel is, even if it's written in the third person, a novel is a first person form. It's about feelings and emotions as well as action and dialogue. With a screenplay, it really is about what people say and do. And that's the toughest thing to get around. That's the hardest leap to make.
Now, we heard David Nichols there talking about adapting his own stuff One Day and adapting much loved, well-known texts like Far From the Madding Crowd. There's an interesting thing here, and I was thinking about this listening to that interview that Megan Billings was doing with David Nichols, about about touching the classics and about how you, how on earth you do that. I mean, his One Day is a much loved best-selling novel, and how you turn that as he was talking about the interior life of a character into action on screen and getting that story across. Philip, is that something that is entirely instinctive, or is that something that is arrived at by sort of hard work, do you think?
I think there is a bit of an instinct there, because I think the essence that you're going to put on the screen is a visual telling of the emotion, and the action is the emotion of the characters and what they want to achieve. And it's a great process of actually then just paring it down. But it's like any script, really. You work on the building blocks of the story, and then you work out what you actually really need to tell the story. Every scene has got to have a purpose. And I think it's amazingly liberating, cutting it right down to the bare bones and thinking that tells the story.
And you're subsuming your ego. If you're adapting your own thing, you know, you can do anything you want with a book. You can do much less because you've got the constraints of a different medium, I suppose, if you're making it into a movie script.
I recently adapted a play I'd written into a sitcom pilot for a company, and I found that incredibly. I thought it was very easy when I was writing it, and I thought it was great. But when I went back to it, after it had been rejected by BBC Scotland, and I went back to it, I thought, oh no, it doesn't work at all on any level. This just doesn't work on any level, because I was trying to capture the spirit of the play, and all of the little, the play was very, very sort of is a dark comedy, and it just didn't work at all. So it's never going to be seen.
There we go. All right, we have it. The Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away, says Philip Meeks. Charmaine, maybe this doesn't sound familiar to you. Maybe it does. I guess there's a lot of treatments that end up on the production room floor and the floor of your own office as well. I wanted to ask you, though, about knowing when something is good, and it's about that thing where it's about capturing dialogue. I mean, films, TV, radio are all about great dialogue rather than lots of set direction and stage direction, I should say, presumably, aren't they? Is that when you're looking, especially maybe for a new writer or something that's sort of coming across your desk for the first time, is that what you're looking for, essentially, is great story and cracking dialogue?
I'm actually really looking for great characters,
right,
more than anything. The producers that I work with are absolutely incredible at basically being able to kind of pick and choose a sort of team, like a creative team. So DNA, for example, who we work with, who made Far From the Madding Crowd, you know, they have a book. They have this wonderful book. They have Hardy. And then they, you know, just to work out that it should be David Nichols and Carey Mulligan, you know, that is absolutely genius. To remind them that the book exists would be, I didn't work on that, but that would be the kind of thing that I would do, is just to remind them that this book is out there and available. And I think, you know, what we're really looking for is great characters, because someone like David Nichols or Philip is going to be able to write the dialogue of these characters and bring them to life for the screen or for the stage. And what we need in a book, and really what we're looking for, is these characters that we just want to know what they're going to do next. And we have to be thinking about these characters long after we finish the book. And we have to go to bed, waking up, wondering what they're going to do next. And this right. sort of insatiable. So really what I'm always looking for me and my team, well, it's always like character first, and then the world that they're in, and then the dialogue is kind of inconsequential in a way, because we know that that's going to be adapted and that the writer is going to give them voice. And so then, you know, when you have a book that is an unreliable narrator, for example, then it becomes quite difficult because you don't trust them. And when you know in the book that you don't trust them, then it's hard to then tell people that they should really trust them on the screen. So what you're looking for is like these really kind of solid characters who just evoke a world that and bring us into a world that we don't really know about, but yes. we can't wait to find out more.
And moves forward. I think that's the really important thing, is that the character and the story is all
Something's
moving
always
forward.
Happening. Yeah.
And I think what's really interesting about what you said about dialogue is, I was saying to somebody the other day, I do a bit of teaching, and I said, I think you should write an essay for his course on, you know, dialogue is the least important thing in screenwriting. And it is the character and the action of the character that really, really is what you've got to get right. And I think the actor is so important in an adaptation. And anything you write that is a script, the acting talent really makes it work.
Yeah.
I spent a lot of years writing soap, and I got very upset about writers who'd say, oh, yes, I created that character. And there's a lot of pomposity in that world amongst writers. And they didn't. The actor did. The actor knows. And if an actor would come up to me and say, I don't think that's what my character would say, I would say, you're right, you're going to know better than anybody else.
And a writer praising an actor, this is what the show is designed for. Unusual moments in the history of broadcasting.
I'd probably get struck by lightning as I leave.
And you started off at the beginning of this programme, Philip, you said one of the golden rules is never throw the book out. To finish this show, maybe we should go back to the text itself then, back to the book. Should that always be used as the backstop, the set text, the thing that every director should have in his back pocket? Is that what we're talking about, Charmaine? Is this always what you should be coming back to?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, that book has been written by someone usually in quite a small dark room, and then they bring it into the world via a publisher, and then that publisher has brought it to hundreds of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of millions of people. And then, you know, there's already an audience that have this expectation of this book. So when you say, I am going to pay X amount to make this book, it means that, you know, you have on the weight of your shoulders of all the people that have bought it. And so it's a huge deal. And I think that, you know, for anyone to say the book should be thrown out, you should then create an original.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why there's brilliant original screenplays. But if you're going to do an adaptation, you have to stay faithful to the book. But it means that you have an artistic license, which is why the film or the television series doesn't always look like the book. But the essence of the book and the characters and the world in which they were in, that they brought to us, has to be there. I think in the end, it's about audiences, you know, it's about bringing stories to audiences. And I think for me, definitely, I've been so enlightened by how a book can do that. And for producers, it's, you know, it gives them so much creative freedom, for producers, for writers and for actors, to really reimagine something that they love. And the passion that a producer has when they're optioning a book is absolutely incredible. And the way that they want to fight tooth and nail to make this book their own and to have it in the vein of their production company is really, really admirable. And it's something that we don't get to see because it's behind the scenes. But really, it's about getting these books from page to screen and from a small audience to a really wide international audience.
Well, how can we disagree with that? Charmaine Lovegrove, thank you very much. Charmaine is co-founder of Dialogue Scouting, the page to screen consultancy. Thank you also to Philip Meeks, thank you for letting us in on some of the dark room stuff, and then some of the kind of wide open-eyed enlightenment stuff as well. Thank you to both my guests very much indeed. So, how do you adapt a novel? Instinct, dear listeners, instinct. And don't do what I did and think that dialogue and story are all important. Adaptations are all about characters. Characters that have to eat you all up and consume you. Hasn't Charmaine Lovegrove got an interesting job too? Her lesson is to find out what people want first, fit your supply to their demand. Makes sense, doesn't it? That brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture, where my producer was, now here's a character, Holly Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bounds, and thanks for tuning in.